This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton. For more information, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.
One of the less discussed areas of change in moving from the Obama administration to Trump's may be involving one of Michelle Obama's agenda items involving healthy eating choices, especially in schools. In fact, many American food companies have been getting more and more on board with the idea of producing healthier foods for the public in general. But apparently, the American public is not always following that lead. Several of the healthier eating items brought forth in the last few years haven't been as successful as their producers would have liked. So the question becomes, where are we headed? Wharton marketing lecturer Jason Reese joins us in studio, as does Karen Glanz, director of the University of Pennsylvania Prevention Research Center. Great to see you both. Happy holidays to you both.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Great to see you. It is interesting that these companies have made this investment. They are trying to make change, not all of them, but you know, they are making their changes where they are, and people have been clamoring for them. Yet, seemingly, these companies are now saying that these products are not doing as well as they probably could be. Your reaction to that, Jason?
PepsiCo has been perhaps the leader, at least the most vocal about this, and perhaps are also the most vulnerable to it compared to Coke because they have such a large packaged food business with Lay's. They spend something like $500 million to $1 billion on research and development, much of it around trying to create foods that are healthier that people will eat. And yeah, it's not meeting the expectations, or at least the sales are not meeting the stated objectives of the CEO that they were hoping to reach by the end of the decade. It's challenging, though. I mean, the R&D is a slow process. And then at the consumer side, you face consumers who have confused understanding of what it actually is to be a healthier food product, limited self-control, at least in the sense that we all want to eat delicious things now. The healthier things we'll eat tomorrow. And we're price sensitive. There's only so much that we're willing to spend. You can get healthier foods, but it costs more money very often.
Karen?
Yeah, I think the things that Jason's pointing out are right on target. This is not a new story, but it's a new era for this story to be coming around again and again. I mean, bottom line, you know, food companies, food production companies are, and especially giant ones like PepsiCo, are in the business of making profit. They're not in the business of trying to create healthier food. Now, they hear the clamor, as you mentioned, and they think it would look good for them to kind of meet that expectation, if you will, at least as it's expressed by consumers, not as heavily practiced. Then you take the issue of the expectations that a product has to be profitable in a short turnaround or it's out the door.
Right.
And that model may be one that's just not going to work for healthier foods. It just may not be long enough. Second issue is a question in my mind that was not touched on in this recent Wall Street Journal article that went into depth about this question and Pepsi's experience with it is, you know, do they market it to death the way that they market unhealthy products to death? You know, as a consumer in the public, not, you know, keeping an eye on these particular products, I haven't seen them being, you know, marketed big time with all the bells and whistles and kid friendliness and fun kind of marketing that we get for the bad stuff.
But to a degree, we've been so conditioned as a society for the Lay's potato chips or the Doritos or you know, you name it, that, I mean, it's almost something that's passed down from generation to generation. And I do agree with you. It may not be something that we will be able to see fully adopted. It may have to be pieces here and there. But as you said, when a company's trying to hit a quarterly report and an earnings statement, it kind of puts their back against the wall.
Yeah. And I think you hit on, you know, one of the other key underlying factors, which is the buildup to our dependence and our, you know, great appetite for the regular Lay's potato chips, the Pringles, the Cheetos, et cetera, has been over many, many years. And it has been built up and built up and built up. And in addition, from a really a biological perspective, the taste, the cravings are not accidental. There's actually a very good book and a top-selling book a couple of years ago by an author named Michael Moss, a journalist, who his book was called Salt, Sugar, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And he goes into what the, you know, the kind of the chemical side of it and the taste buds and how, you know, these products didn't accidentally take off. So it's that combination of the research behind them and the marketing of them over long term.
Yeah, it makes it hard for the healthier products to compete. It makes it hard to do research and development to get those products to taste good when what they're up against is an already heavily engineered product that was designed to taste perfectly to match our physiology.
So what you guys are saying, we're not going to see any ads for these types of food items in the Super Bowl, you know, trying to reach that that massive marketing angle.
I wouldn't say that. And we do see them for some of the beverages, the lower calorie beverages,
sure,
at least. But what PepsiCo and the other food giants would argue is that the return on marketing dollars on products that have a high turn, the ones that are sold much more frequently, that return is going to be much higher for PepsiCo.
So is there a distinction in your mind, but when you're talking about these products, Karen, is there a distinction between the food elements and the drinks? Because it seems like there is a difference in terms of people being more willing to accept different types of drinks that may be, you know, not necessarily the Cokes or the Pepsis compared to the food items.
Well, yeah, I think that the at least for top sellers like Pepsi and Coke, let's start with them.
Yeah.
The calorie-free or low-calorie, low-sugar alternatives are well-established. They sell much less than the sugary versions.
Sure.
But they sell well. They sell well enough to have a following and to definitely be kept on the shelves. Now, if you look at some of the alternative beverages that have been tried out, some of them have, like, bombed, healthy or non-healthy. Like, there were a couple of Coke ones that are not to cause the pun, but were classic, not Coke classic, but that were, you know, that were tried out, that were much ballyhooed and, you know, didn't last at all. And, you know, if we could go behind the curtain, Jason and I can't from where we sit, you know, and see how much is marketing and how much is instinct of marketers,
right,
and of corporate leaders, you know, and how that comes together may be also part of what's behind this dilemma.
How much do you think it is that balance, you know, the mindset compared to the actual data that some of these companies are collecting?
There's only so much data that they can get. It's very hard to predict whether or not products will be adopted. And to some extent, they just have to try things, throw them out there, and see how consumers react.
Right.
Your implicit hypothesis is interesting, that perhaps it's easier to do that in the beverage category. And I don't know if product development is easier there. An interesting trend we've seen in the beverage category, though, is that while it's true that diet sodas are a smaller share of overall soda, they've actually been declining even faster than sugared soda in the last year or so. Their sales have absolutely tanked because of concerns that artificial sweeteners have negative health implications. I don't think that those health implications are documented very well. I've actually been a big fan of diet sodas as a potential public health improvement relative to sugared sodas, but it seems the public at least is not buying that anymore.
Well, where do you sit then? I'll even throw one in as well. Where do you sit on these zero-calorie drinks? Where do you sit on those as well?
Well, first of all, Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi are zero-calorie drinks, although that's not in their headline.
Right.
The beverage market is interesting, and I think, as you point out, may, you know, have a slightly different trajectory than the food and snack product.
How so?
Type of market. Well, when you think the diversification of the beverage market in the last 5 to 10 years has been enormous, and some of it gives the appearance of being different, like a lot of non-carbonated beverages have like really taken off flavored waters. And those often come in sugary and zero calorie versions. And they've usually been developed by some company or some entrepreneur out there and then acquired by the giants like Pepsi or Coke. So a lot of these flavored beverages kind of had their proving ground outside the investment of, you know, the mega corporations, and then were bought up. They sell well. They don't sell as well as the old standards, but they sell well enough to kind of pay their way. We happen to be studying beverages a lot in my own research, and it's just, you know, endlessly diverse range of beverages. And there is often the impression that some of those beverages are healthy when they absolutely are not.
Right.
You know, when they are a sugared tea, and people think, well, iced tea, you know, lemon iced tea, that's got to be good for you. Or things that are even called vitamin water.
Right.
That aren't. And that, you know, again, they come in both versions, the sugary and the non-sugary. But clearly the sugary ones are selling or they wouldn't be out there.
844-WHARTON is the number if you'd like to join in. 844-942-7866 is the number to give us a call. Going back to your point where it does feel like that these products do have a spot in the consumer's mind, whatever that level is. But are these companies making too much of this in their mindset in trying to bring these forward? Because as you said, there's probably a lot of data behind it from our bodies and how we react to certain tastes and all kinds of things that just would lead you to believe that that you're not going to see a change in this going down the road.
I guess I would take, you know, the stand that if they really want to be the ones, be the company that, you know, that has these healthier products that do take off, they might have to step back and hold it to a different standard than they do for the ones that have been out there for, you know, decades, well established, and as Jason pointed out, you know, we're addicted. So it's not to say that they can't happen, and it's, they have done the research so that they have, you know, don't put the awful tasting ones out on the shelves.
But you almost need to have a company be able to have the success and to be able to be the size of a Coke or a PepsiCo to be able to, you know, kind of almost blaze a trail for this going forward, right?
Yeah, and I suppose we haven't seen that emerge. The way that might happen is if they can find the consumer base that's most interested in this, the consumer base that has most embraced the public health challenge of obesity and calorie-dense foods and beverages.
And that said, may not be here in the United States.
No, it may not be, but there's the United States is huge. There's a large subsegment that is interested in that. Now, I think that subsegment is very skeptical of the big food companies because of their history. They tend to support smaller independent brands. When those brands get bought by Coke and Pepsi, they may stick with them, they may not, or they may look for the next best thing.
844-942-7866 is the number to give us a call. As I mentioned at the top, Michelle Obama has obviously made a big push in terms of trying to get people to eat healthier and obviously the programs with schools going forward. I don't think there's much, you know, much doubt that those programs have benefited the lives of so many kids going forward. I guess the hope is that those traditions, those kind of habits will continue once these kids graduate high school and go on to college or, you know, get out into the society, that's going to be the way to really kind of change the pattern of eating and what you eat going forward. It's almost a cycle that you can't think of it, as you said, at an overnight basis. This has to be almost like a 20 or 30 year process to be able to get these types of changes made, correct?
Yeah. I mean, the First Lady has done a tremendous amount to put a face and a likable face and a tremendous amount of energy and, you know, kind of authority from the highest level of government into healthy eating, into healthy eating for kids and healthy eating in schools. She herself has not, and she shouldn't be, you know, running the programs or, right. you know, fixing the foods, but she's had this overall umbrella effect that I think has been really favorable in general. So I don't think we could, like, attribute, you know, specific changes because what she's doing isn't being evaluated at that granular level. But it has been great. It has been great to have that attention. What will happen when she moves out of the White House? I don't know. Jason, I can speculate.
Yeah, we don't know yet. I don't think the USDA, I don't think a USDA appointee has been named yet. And we'll see. Much will depend on that. There are certainly rumblings from some members of Congress that some of her programs need to be rolled back. But that probably is going to be an uphill battle, and I would think a tough one to fight. On what grounds do you fight something like that, that childhood obesity isn't a problem or that kids don't need to be eating more vegetables? Those are tough claims to make. The claims that we'll make is that it's too much regulation and it's too much burden for the cafeterias and the companies that manage them to do this. But there are active research programs working with these cafeteria managers and larger companies that manage school cafeterias. A lot of collaboration, and they're having impact.
But a lot of people, for a lot of kids, and this goes to, you know, the education cycle, I think, in general, for a lot of these kids, these meals that they may be getting in these schools are the best ones that they're going to have in the course of their day. So they take on an unbelievable level of importance going forward.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I mentioned fruits and vegetables in lunch meals, but there's the breakfast program that give low-income kids
sure.
a meal to start the day that lets them actually concentrate on work while they're in school rather than on the fact that they're hungry. It would seem yeah. a tough argument to push that back.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, there are multiple ways to pick up on what Jason is saying, to look at this. I think the government, the First Lady in particular, and her program, her signature program, has been a catalyst for programs through the government, through federal, state, local, and also through nonprofits and other organizations that are, you know, health promoting. And I agree, it's like hard to say, well, what's good for kids, we're against that. So on the one hand, it has a shot of continuing on that basis because yeah. we see good things starting to happen and know that it's going to take a long time. On the other hand, we have a president-elect who is against regulation.
Sure.
And yeah. regulation is a part of the picture of feeding programs in schools and so forth. And again, as Jason said, you know, he hasn't named an agriculture secretary, which could also make a big difference.
It really is, and I'm going to take this to a personal perspective for a second. It truly is something that ends up falling in the laps of the parents as well, because I see it with my oldest daughter and my little ones to a degree about some of the choices that she makes. Like, my son loves to eat peppers. You know, the fact that he, you know, he's seven and he loves to eat peppers. My older daughter, you know, when she wants to go have something to drink, she goes to have water. You know, she doesn't, every once in like 3 months, she'll want to have a soda. But other than that, she'll drink water most of the day. So it, from that perspective, the parents can make these changes happen, whether they're realizing they're not doing it yeah. or not. It's just the process of the parents thinking about this even more.
Absolutely, and you got lucky with your kids, as well as, you know, that you've done a good job and they've been exposed that way. Part of the challenge comes about in the lower income and the disadvantaged kids, where parents are less likely to take that on as a cause. Is that they may have just keeping the heat and the lights on and paying yeah. the rent as a priority, and then this kind of falls in the background. So those are, it's kind of like when we think about a safety net for health insurance, this is like a safety net for food insecurity and food as it relates to health. Those are the people that do need the school and the government to take some initiative to bolster that.
Jason?
Yeah, and I think it's actually possible there's scenarios where the things that kids learn in school can have an impact not just on them with respect to eating habits, but on the home life as well.
Right.
Food outside of the home, whether it's quick serve or casual dining, those rates have skyrocketed in a generation. We're cooking less at home. We know less about cooking at home. And that's partly to the credit of the fast food and casual dining industry. They make great stuff that's inexpensive and affordable for everybody.
Yeah.
But that does leave us with less incentive to get good, at cooking vegetables and such at home.
Well, and that part plays into the fact that, many people, not all, but many people have such busier lives to begin with in general. I'll take this to the personal perspective. Three kids and they're all playing sports of some kind. There's not a day during the week that I'm not running around going somewhere. And there are times where you just don't have enough time to be able to prepare a good meal for them. You need to kind of grab something on the go. And that ends up being obviously the benefit for fast food, fast casual, whatever it may be, but it ends up being the negative in terms of the health issue going forward.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Karen?
You put it in perspective, but you also do mention sports and kids. And so there is this equation. There's the food and the activity side of things. And again, the First Lady's initiatives have also been called Let's Move. And so there really is that the two sides to the coin. And there's been a real challenge in schools. Physical education has been cut back.
Yeah.
Recesses have been cut back. That's actually something that's now being considered, a target for improving, getting kids out to recess where they just move and they're not being told they have to run to pick up a ball. So they kind of go together in this healthy lifestyle.
Right.
And kids that are more affluent, the suburban kids are going to be likely to get exposed to that in the course of, everyday life. And some of the disadvantaged kids may not have that opportunity. And so it has to be somehow, bolstered for them.
What's an interesting statistic that comes in this Wall Street Journal story is the fact that they say that natural and organic foods and beverages are up 23% in the last 2 years alone, up to like $41 billion in terms of sales. Yet the overall number, for sales is $425 billion. So, that's still less than 10% of the overall picture of food and beverage here in the United States. But at least that pattern is heading in the right direction rather than heading in the reverse.
It is. It is. Becoming a thing, if you will, and it is increasing. I myself wonder what's included in that category because not everything that's organically produced is necessarily healthy from the point of view of calories, sugar, fat, obesogenic, things that cause obesity, diabetes, etc. So I wonder if you tear that apart, what you would find. But it's easy to see an increase when you're starting from a really low number.
Sure, yeah.
If nothing else, it shows an interest in that there is some consumer base who are interested in eating more healthfully. Karen is the nutritionist, but my impression is from the research that I've read that there's very little evidence that organic and natural equate with healthier in any meaningful sense. They're not inherently lower calorie.
Right.
And lower calorie is kind of public health problem or priority number one. Karen, you may see it differently.
No, I think you hit it spot on. That's really the case. Organic, unfortunately, is often been used by some food producers and sellers as a buzzword to appeal to a certain
right.
segment of the audience without truly being any healthier.
Well, it's more expensive, that's for sure.
And it's not a regulated, area in terms of what right. you can claim.
But that's the interesting point going back to your area, Jason, is the marketing of it. And, people that have that perception, they have a perception of organic or natural, and the understanding that that perception may not always be actually factually correct is something that probably still a lot of people have to get past. And it's obviously something that a lot of the food companies are willing to just kind of go down the path with.
Yeah, and it's hard to complain with them making that a priority. Organic is a fantastic marketing tool, and if it's in the direction of healthier, even a little bit, they're not going to get grief for pursuing that. But it's a great way to sell products that are higher priced.
844-WHARTON is the number to give us a call. 844-942-7866. If you'd like to give us a call right now, 844-942-7866. If you'd like to join in, or if you can't get to your phone, send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio111 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. I guess then, in terms of pattern of what we may see, understanding who the agriculture secretary may be and who will kind of be the person at the point of this for the Trump administration will kind of open the door as to where we may head in some of these ideas going forward.
I think that's true. I do also think, though, that there is a certain amount of momentum, as Jason pointed out, and from what I've seen over the past several decades, it looks better than before, but there are a lot of forces in both directions.
Yeah.
Jason?
Who knows? He may appoint a Democrat. I've read some accounts that suggest that he will. I don't think he's appointed a Democrat yet. Maybe he'll see it as a worthwhile gesture to do so.
Reaching across the aisle while reaching across the table for another piece of food, right?
Well done, Dan.
Thank you very much. I've been saving that for the whole half hour if I possibly could. Great to see you both. Happy holidays to you both.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Great to have you.
For more business news and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.